Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, January 22nd, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio. There is a government shutdown, but that'll disappear soon because there's going to be a deal that no one is happy with, probably. I'm Austin Walker. Joining me today, Danielle Riendo.
Hello.
Rob Zachney.
Hey, everybody.
And the woke gamer himself, Patrick Clark.
God, everyone missed my great joke. We should edit that back into the podcast somehow. Oh. Just drop it in.
Just drop it back in right here.
Dropping.
God. We're going to talk about video games today, even though the world seems to continuously be a raging shit fire, which is, but you know what, what's great is it turns out video games have their own raging shit fires. Here's a headline, from Kotaku: David Cage's Quantic Dream accused of being a toxic workplace. Update. And the update is, the co-CEO of Quantic Dream saying that he will take all possible legal actions to defend his honor. Quote unquote, and that is a good. So this actually happened, I guess, not this past weekend, but the weekend before, and we didn't do a Monday show last week. And I feel like David Cage and Quantic Dream have been such a constant on our show, especially with the lead into Detroit. For people who maybe don't know the name offhand, David Cage is the CEO of Quantic Dream, one of the CEOs of Quantic Dream, which is a developer that's made games like Indigo Prophecy, Heavy Rain, Beyond Two Souls. You can go all the way back to Omicron, which starred David Bowie in it.
Hell yeah, Omicron.
And we have, like, I think we've had, I don't, I think this show has had a pretty firm stance on David Cage, but I'd say myself, I had an arc from, like, love to hate that, like, as I became more mature and revisited some of his games as I got older, I came away liking them less and less until finally with Beyond, I all of my affection was shattered, minus one or two scenes where he's still kind of, or not he, but the studio kind of nails it. But this story came out of Kotaku. This story actually came out not from Kotaku. Kotaku did a good write-up. Eurogamer did a good write-up. But they originated in three different French outlets, which when that happens, you know, when that happens, I tend to believe that there is enough smoke to count some fire.
Two of them worked, from what I understand, collaborated on.
Yeah, I think Canard PC and Mediapart collaborated.
Yeah, they published separate articles, but I guess we're sharing some information.
And can we just say when the French press thinks something's sexist that something's got to be real bad for that to happen.
And Le Monde was the third, which is a kind of a world-renowned, newspaper. I'm just going to read from the Kotaku story here to get people caught up. According to Le Monde's report, by way of Eurogamer, five former employees filed a complaint in the spring of 2017 against the company and one of its employees for circulating degrading images. In February of 2017, a trove of 600 photoshops of various employees that were homophobic or sexist in nature, and some of which even included Nazi symbols, was discovered by an IT manager who had been the subject of one of them. That's, don't fuck with the IT manager. That's how you get got. These files dated back to 2013, with some even displayed in the open spaces. Although studio heads David Cage and Guillaume de Fondmier claim that they were not aware of the offensive ones. On top of all of that, there's just kind of an overview of what the culture is like. There is, writing, especially if you go through the Eurogamer piece. They talk about how, there's a big dick on a dick that farts on one of the walls, which is great. There's just an amazing moment in the Le Monde story. I believe it's the Le Monde story that is like David Cage telling a reporter that the culture isn't toxic there, and behind him is the giant dick farting, which is like, that's good. But then also just like racist remarks, racist jokes. Made to people of color on staff. This is from the Eurogamer story. One incident involved burglary caught on CCTV after watching Cage allegedly asked an employee of Tunisian descent, "Is that a cousin of yours?"
Oh my god.
there's also just a very, like, he can do whatever he wants. This isn't a safe space. This is his space. This is, like, dirty jokes, a smutty, quote, smutty remarks in the presence of his wife and inappropriate remarks about actresses in his games. And then this just beautiful, beautiful note. Cage, beautiful, deeply sarcastic here. Cage, Cage particularly is painted as a figure hard to work with. He is apparently ironically nicknamed Papa, God, and Sun King for his autocratic approach to working, for demanding long hours and not listening to others.
You can't give yourself your own nickname. You can't be T-Bone. You can't be Sun King.
Especially in France, where Sun King is like a very specific reference to Louis the 14th, right? Like, don't didn't they kill that motherfucker?
No, they killed his grandson.
Oh, you're right.
No, Louis the 14th is the guy who like creates the modern state of France, right, and is like a epoch-defining luminary.
Oh. Right. Like David Cage, who has defined gaming as high art. Finally, we have an artist among us.
Well, I mean, Louis XIV was famous for saying that he wanted to make France as good as a Hollywood movie. That is indeed what he achieved.
And he pulled it off.
And what he's best remembered for.
Yeah, exactly. Of course.
In what year? He was so ahead of his time. This was what, 1790s at this point?
Before that.
Yeah, I mean, it took like 200 years for people to even figure out what the hell he was even saying.
Yeah, so ahead of his time.
God. So I think this comes from the rash, in the middle of a rash of obviously lots of ongoing conversations around kind of sexism in media, in entertainment, in the world in general. Also, you know, even in just our little corner of the world, this comes in just after accusations about some shitty culture at Naughty Dog, which it feels like no one has talked about in a little while.
Yeah.
Probably because people who are doing reporting on that story are doing reporting on that story, and that sort of reporting takes a long time, and you kind of have to be nose down or head down. Your nose has to be really in it. But it's one of those things where it's like, I wanted to bring it up because it would be very easy to be like, oh, that news was 2 weeks ago. It's not that big of a deal. Move on now. And it sucks. Like, this game is going to come out. This game that's tackling exactly these, like, not these issues, but is aiming to tackle issues like race and sexual violence and, you know, all of the things that we've been, like, eyebrows raised on because we haven't really trusted Cage's track record here. It's now tarnished even further by knowing that, at least by some accounts, the culture of the studio is exactly the wrong sort of place to be trying to tackle these sorts of very complex and delicate topics.
Well, there's a bit in one of the articles that talks about the team or elements of the team saying, like, hey, you're going to get some pushback for this clip you're going to put out that seems extremely misogynistic and fucked up. Which is the bit from the Paris Games Week last October, and you know him pushing back that in his sun god complex, and you know essentially just you know what I make is what I make, and you know put up or shut up, and you know there's also a pervasive sense in the reporting that there's a lot of high turnover and exhaustion, and like the you know like 50 to 60 different people have left in the last 12 months, which is probably that's not a great number. Mm-hmm. You know, I would also imagine this game has been in a perpetual crunch for, you know, this is me reading between the lines, but given the way that this game has had like ephemeral release dates for the better part of 2 years, suggests it's a game that's had a lot of turmoil and late nights to get it into a place where it is supposedly going to release this spring. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Austin. It creates does not create the right atmosphere or creates an interesting atmosphere to go into playing that game when that is surrounding the game itself.
I think one of the most insane quotes from this, and also one of the most sort of disgusting and pervasive attitudes we see around this at a larger piece as well, is like a quote that's in this piece. I'm looking at the Kotaku piece. You're reported from Le Monde, where Cage is reportedly saying, "You want to talk about homophobia? I work with Ellen Page, who fights for LGBT rights. You want to talk about racism? I work with Jesse Williams, who fights for civil rights in the USA. Judge me by my work." And it's like,
that's not a good. That's not a good line to end on, David. Because if we start judging you by your work, then we have some extremely problematic shit to talk about.
Also, you're literally asking us to judge you by your connections instead of your work.
Exactly. Hiding behind other people is the most cowardly, shitty thing And this is something you see all the time when people are accused of toxic behavior or accused of harassment or misconduct. Like, they're like, no, it couldn't be me. I, you know, voted for Hillary or whatever. You know, whatever bullshit.
I would have voted for Obama for a third term.
Yep, that exactly.
Thank you, get out. Yeah, exactly.
Well, like, also, if we ask Ellen Page,
yes,
what's she actually going to say about that experience?
God.
Well, and let's conveniently for remember that wasn't there like a whole like you know, when they captured her like nude and that got hacked in the game, and she was like,
she was exploring legal action against Sony because there were images that leaked online of her character model nude, but in the game she's never seen as fully nude, and it's not, and so she's like, why is this even a thing that's in there? Like, why would you ever even actually have the naked model of me in the game if you're not, like, that's not a thing we agreed to? And so she explored legal option, apparently, or legal action against Sony, but I don't think anything actually shook out from it.
So I'm not sure Ellen Page is going to have the nicest things to say.
No, no. I mean, there is that very convenient and probably just based on timing photo of Ellen Page and Willem Dafoe, like, looking away, like, side-eyeing Cage. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Oh, back when they're doing the press tour stuff?
Yeah. It's so good. It's so perfect. And, yeah, I think that the other thing here, too, is just, like, it is frustrating because we have talked so much about how games like this could have a place in games culture if they came out of the kind of right studio culture with kind of limited ambition or adjusted ambition, and came out of a sort of love of kind of cheesy bullshit. And instead, what we're left with is a studio that, on one hand, goes out and stands on a stage and gets applauded for what they claim to be doing, which is breaking down, you know, boundaries and you know, leading games into a bright future, making people think. And then not only are the actual allegations really terrible, and again, you know, they are allegations. I think that these are credible allegations based on who the reporters are, based on what the outlets are, based on the fact that it's coming from three different sources. But you have an image of a deeply immature studio head, deeply toxic culture, and then even just judging on the responses, the response from Cage saying, "Judge me by my work," which is what the quote he gave to Le Monde in response to these allegations. The response from the co-CEO, DeFondamiere, who says, "Quantic Dream categorically denies the allegations. As for myself, I'm furious and outraged by these accusations, which I take very seriously, and I will take all possible legal actions to defend my honor," is like, you are not taking them seriously. If you're taking them seriously, what you say is like, oh shit, we got to investigate. Like, we got to clean house. We have to take steps to prevent this from happening. Oh shit, we fucked up. And how do we make sure that we don't fuck up again? Yeah. You're not taking them seriously if you're like, all right, pistols at dawn, motherfucker. Like, that's not taking seriously these claims.
One of the things that's scary about this era is that performative umbrage has almost replaced like internal introspection and accountability. I mean, we saw a little bit of this with Naughty Dog's response to allegations about you know, treatment of an employee who had harassment issues where it was a very quick, you know, we looked into it and we gave ourselves a clean bill of health. And we're very proud of that, and we take this of course very, very seriously. But you see the same thing, you know, with regard to political scandals as well. This idea that, like, if you just act sufficiently offended that someone is even making the accusation, you know, in the eyes of a lot of passive observers, that will suffice to sort of close the book on it, right? So it's,
I mean, this was like nearly the Roy Moore story this year, right? Like, or last year.
But I think the other thing with this is just, I really need to start believing people when they tell me who they are.
Yeah.
Because if you look at David Cage, for a long time I've sort of written him off as like a mostly harmless, like, aesthetic clown in some ways, whose ambitions are informed by, you know, just the trashiest of like Hollywood prestige movies, but actually has no real like artistic vision or insight. But if you look at the things he's created, there often is an element where he's trying to do something that will like win him that like that element of prestige, right? Oh, this game's going to be about race. I'm working with Willem Dafoe and Ellen Page on this one. There's a lot of superficial elements of I'm making a prestige play here.
Right.
But then when you look at what he creates, why are the female characters almost universally wildly underwritten and then also transformed into a sexual reward for the hero?
Or else sexually assaulted, right? Yep. One or the other.
Why are his tech demos?
Yeah. Or both, right.
Always centered on being like, of just like observing a vulnerable woman, right? Like the original Heavy Rain, teaser was the classic, like, hysterical ex-girlfriend trope, basically holding you at gunpoint. Why was the teaser trailer for Detroit Become Human, the thing, the prototype Kara, they saw ages ago, was a sexualized android begging for her life.
Right.
Why does this keep happening? And it turns out that's really his from the sound of it, from the story, that's his actual vision. That's his actual worldview. And everything else is just gilding around that to make it seem like he has a larger point other than objectification and exploitation.
Yeah, I think it is one of those things where it's going to be... The thing that's weird is we haven't had the moment of... What was the movie Kevin Spacey was just replaced in?
Oh, yeah.
All the Money in the World.
What was it? One more time?
All the Money in the World.
Yeah.
All the Money in the World, in which they did reshoots with... Who did they recast for that role? I forget who it was.
Plummer, isn't that the...
Yes, Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, Chris Plummer, yeah. We haven't had that moment in gaming, and I don't know when or if we will, and obviously this isn't about reshoots with something like Detroit, but it is... Like, as the editor-in-chief of Waypoint, I have to think very hard about what coverage looks like for that game at this point. I think we've spoken before about how I think we dropped the ball with our initial Life is Strange Before the Storm coverage last year because of failure to talk about the strike and how scab labor and all that stuff with regards to Before the Storm, and how like we course corrected. People responded like, hey, y'all didn't bring this up at all. We expected you to bring this up. Our readership did that. And they were right, because that was an issue that we have been very vocal about. We covered the voice actor strike. We wrote long pieces about it. We dug into the complexities of it. We were like one of the few outlets that said, hey, this isn't actually about what you think of as residuals. This is about bonuses. And like, let's break that out for you. And then an example came where the game was exactly the sort of thing we should have been paying attention to the labor angle, and we dropped the ball. And so now I'm thinking a lot about what coverage of Detroit looks like here. And I know I'm confident in our ability to tackle it critically really well, but like, I'm curious what the preview cycle for this game looks like across the industry right now. I'm curious how outlets cover this and whether or not this story shows up. I'm curious if this is a case... I mean, we've spoken about this stuff before a little bit here or there, but there's kind of a spectrum of how you bring in the complexities of the outside world into a story or into your coverage, right? Like, there's this sort of like, okay, we're going to give the audience the information they need, the reader the information they need to come to their own conclusions. There's the, I'm just not willing to give my platform to this person because they're a fucking bigot. And I'm up in the air a little bit on Detroit right now, which is not to say we're not going to cover it at all, but like...
It sort of depends on what the game wants to say, right? Like, because we know ultimately so little about what, like, for as much as we have seen of that game in various scenes, like, I still couldn't give you like a good sense of like what that game is going to be or like where it lands.
Right,
and,
well,
and I think that ends up informing like how much of, you know, that outside stuff influences how, like, because there's a world where the very things it touches, it's impossible to talk about that game without considering, you know, what we know about its the environment it was created in.
Well, it's funny because Rob and I had just been on the Vice Guide to Right Now, which is Vice's daily podcast, where the podcast producer here, Sophie, was like, hey, like, y'all talk good.
It had just been 12 hours later.
I know, dude. I know.
Oh, no.
She was like, oh, you guys do a good job talking about video games all the time. I had just done this podcast. I was just on Here and Now, which is an NPR podcast about what's happening right here and right now. And I talked about 2017 and 2018 in games and politics and stuff like that. And she was like, oh, she had recorded my side of that conversation. And so she was like, oh, it would be cool if you guys could do something similar, maybe a little bit more focused for the Vice Guide to right now. And so Rob and I, Rob was in town, like, oh, yeah, we'll talk about politics in the beginning of the year or the games throughout the beginning of 2018. And one of those was Detroit Become Human. And this was, like you said, Rob, like 12 hours before those stories hit, maybe 24. And we were skeptical about it, as we have always been, but we left the door open and said, like, well, but who knows? Like, maybe all of the violence meter shit, there will be the twist that says, hey, actually, like, you tried to win via respectability politics, and you can't win with these people with respectability politics. The only people who win with respectability politics are shitty white dudes who get to say how respectable they are and get away with murder. And we said that, and then, like, 24 hours later, this happened, and it's like, well, and it feels like it just closes that possibility somewhat. Like, it doesn't, actually. Who knows? We all know that a studio makes a game, an individual doesn't make a game, but when the guy is called Sun King internally, it's hard to not feel like the touch of this stuff is going to run through that game.
Well, and it feels very much that David Cage, you know, has a sort of like Kojima-like persona in regards to like how his games are developed, in which, yes, there is a support team that, you know, makes that game happen. It is the work of a team, not of purely an individual. But the way that both the games are framed in their marketing and in the way that we've kind of come to understand how they are made, you cannot separate that chief persona from like the work writ large, and mm-hmm. that is just kind of the nature of it. Like, yes, hundreds of people work to build this, but you can't extract those elements from the person at the top. And that is true for some games and not true for others, but it seems with this is very much that kind of game.
Totally. Speaking of cyberpunk games that have some content issues and lots of ambition, I'd say.
Yep.
Danielle, you and I both played through a game called Red String Club. The Red Strings Club?
Yes.
The Red String Diaries?
Red Strings Club. The Red Strings Club, which is a cyberpunk game set in the somewhat far future. It's trading right in a lot of tropes about a cyberpunk
this
game.
Is Deconstruct Team, right?
Yes,
this
is
the team behind Gods Will Be Watching, which was I don't even know how to describe Gods Will Be Watching. Also a sci-fi game.
Adventure game?
Adventure puzzle, I'd say.
Yeah, adventure puzzle.
Like, it was that game was all about, like, monitoring resources and timers and, like, trying to break into places before everything blew up. It was very weird.
It was very brutal, too.
It was very brutal. Brutally hard.
Turned off a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that in this, but I wouldn't say that's the bulk of it. What was your experience with it? Can you explain the game a little bit for me?
So I'll be clear that I really loved it until I think it took a misstep, and I won't spoil anything. But generally, it's a sort of a 2D, you know, sort of beautiful pixel art cyberpunk game that looks like what you think of when you think of a cyberpunk game. There's a lot of cityscapes, there's a lot of neon, there's a lot of drinking in a little bar that has a piano and like a red fan. It's only missing the drapes, like the Venetian blinds, that kind of lighting. Basically you are playing as Donovan, at least for most of the game, who is a bartender who makes drinks that suit people's different aspects of their personalities to get information, because you're an information broker, of course, and you work with a bunch of cool hackers who are trying to bring down the evil corporations, and there are a whole bunch of evil corporations, but there is one in particular that is an evil corporation with a heart, or at least that's sort of how it's presented.
Yeah.
And said evil corporation has a plot, and this is really the sort of the central conflict of the game. This isn't really spoiling anything, I don't think, but it has a central plot to do something to humanity that they think will make everybody happy, but a lot of people are not interested in conforming to this thing that will make everybody happy.
I think it's fair to say, I think, like, the heart of this game is a discussion about, like, brainwashing,
yes,
basically, right?
Yeah.
Or, like, cultural brainwashing in some regards. And in fact, the thing that I kept coming back to is the Red Strings Club felt like an actually well-intended and maybe even better informed version of what the developer of The Last Night, that other cyberpunk game,
yeah,
that the Milkshake Duck cyberpunk game from E3 last year, said he wanted to write about,
yeah,
and make a game about, right? the kind of core conflict or core conversation throughout this game is like, hey, if you could snap your fingers and make the world a better place, would you? What would that world look like? What does that mean for people's autonomy? Like, should we live in a world where it's okay for bad things to happen, because, and for people to be sad and for people to be depressed and like for people to be hurt, or it would it be better to live in a world without all of that stuff? But also with, by, you know, in that way, autonomy seemingly being kind of, minimized.
I think it handles all of that stuff pretty well.
Yeah. I actually think that it handles all that stuff really well. One of my favorite things, and I don't know if this worked for you, Danielle, but like you have these conversations with a character playing as Donovan, who is this bartender. Someone comes in, you have conversations with the person who came in, you put them in a certain mood based on the drinks that you make. You know, you mix together these four drinks basically that depending on the combination can put them in one of a couple of moods that they have access to. You're not just like pulling from a list. It's not like you say like, okay, I can make them angry, I can make them sad, I can make them happy, I can make them powerful, whatever.
Moods are aspects of their own personalities that they're bringing into the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then you talk to them and you have a conversation, and it's conveniently almost everyone you serve drinks to is tied into this big conspiracy that you're working through. You're never just really serving drinks to randos, which I kind of wish it did have.
Kind of tied in.
It still ends up being kind of tied in.
Yeah.
After that, you have a conversation with someone who's there helping you in the bar, who is like, hey, what do you think about one? It's like, what's up with this, with the person you just talked to? Like, kind of like break down what you think that conversation was really about. And then it follows up with that with like a question about society and about like, hey, do you think marketing is evil? And one of the things I really liked about this game that really worked was that the main character, Donovan, had good answers for the devil advocate kind of responses that came. So, like, if you said, marketing is evil, the character who you're talking to is like, oh, but doesn't that mean XYZ? And then your character's like, yeah, but, like, no, like, that's stupid. You can't just say... So, for instance, the marketing one was like, do you believe that marketing is evil? And if your character's like, yeah, it takes away our autonomy, it is filled with propaganda, like it keeps the rich, it keeps those in power powerful. I don't believe that anything that's sole reason to exist is to move your mind on something is good. The person who you're talking to can say like, or does say something similar to, yeah, but don't art and music and culture and stories do that too? And your character's just like, stop it. Like, no, like, yes, of course art and culture move you, but those aren't always those are not built for the sole exclusive purpose to keep the powerful. And like actually has a good response to that. And I thought that was a really good touch, because otherwise it would have felt like this really weird devil's advocacy, like all sides are wrong thing. I felt like you could get through a lot of it feeling like you had a good handle on an ethos,
on a firm position. And there's also nuanced answers, which I really appreciate as well. It does allow you to do the yes but, which is really nice. It feels like a more sophisticated, in terms of the writing itself and the choices you can make, it does feel like a much more sophisticated take on a lot of these issues that are very, very sort of pure cyberpunk. Like, there's a lot of stuff with AI as well. There's a lot of stuff on the ethics of sort of changing your brain, like having implants to do certain things for you. There's a lot of things around the ethics of what's right to do to an AI, what's, you know, not right to do to an AI, as well as these sort of much larger societal questions. I do think the sort of societal questions are the crux of the game, and I really appreciated that. And I also appreciated that this game let me kind of pick a profile for Donovan that was like very specifically for certain things and against other things, and maybe some of those contradicted, but that's what I feel. So it kind of let me have that.
To be hypocritical.
Exactly. Which was awesome. I think
speaking of hypocritical, unfortunately.
Exactly. Right? I was going to say, I think the game also does some really cool things in terms of sexuality, and it also falls completely and utterly on its face and bleeds out of its face with another aspect. Again, I don't want to spoil anything, but it's worth saying there are some really cool moments in terms of like queer, like positive queer representation, and there's a really fucked up moment that is pretty transphobic.
I'm willing to say that like there's a character who gets dead named in this game in a way that is like
bad,
really shitty, It's really lazy. Like I as a writer, it was, there are so many solutions to the narrative problem that the game gets itself in towards the end.
Yeah.
And there is no reason that, you know, here's what it feels like to me. And this is completely me saying, like, gut feeling, is that the game wanted to include a trans character. Mm-hmm. And did not, I don't know why they didn't just address it in a more straight up way, because it deals with a lot of other issues of gender and of sexuality very directly.
Yeah.
But it feels like this was supposed to be some sort of well-intentioned, like, oh, that character was trans, she was great.
Yeah.
And it's just not. It's just the opposite of that entirely. It's just like, it's gross. It's like a very gross play, and it takes away from something. It takes away from something that had been good, because it immediately complicates an earlier depiction of that character. Yeah. Because she then starts to fall into a bunch of other tropes that trans characters often get placed with, and it's just so fucking frustrating. Yeah. Because you want to support the work that, like, takes risks and does try to tackle complex topics that, like, are tackled throughout the game, but at the same time, it's such a fundamental misplay that I can't imagine people being happy with it. Like, it's tough.
Yeah, it's really shitty. And my god, would have been like, actually, and I feel comfortable saying this, there's an easy fix. There was an easy fix for this. Like,
there's a million easy fixes.
Like, yeah,
like the way it was handled, it was just like entirely unnecessary. Yes. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. This is like, you know, this is not what it is, but it's basically like, there's a door, the door has a lock on it, and the key has the dead name on
basically.
It. And it's like,
yeah.
Why do, you could just had a key. You could have done anything
exactly.
else. The key could have had anything else on it. It's so frustrating.
What is it? So, like, is it just grossly incompetent, or is it trying to showcase, like, a shitty transphobic worldview?
No,
that, like,
I don't,
like,
think
is
so.
Is it saying, like, ah, transphobia is here, and it's still in this world, but...
If it was doing that, they had other vectors to do yeah. that with much more directly.
This reads as gross incompetence to me, especially because it, as part of this sort of general line of dialogue, there's a sort of a moment of acknowledging, oh, this corporation, I'm glad they paid for your healthcare. Like, there's a moment of trying to say something about, like, a good corporation will pay for trans healthcare. It feels like they wanted yeah. to say, again, I can't tell you what the developers were actually thinking, but my read
right,
is
right.
that they were trying to say something positive and absolutely fucked it up. Like, really fucked it up.
Well, yeah, the thing there too that's interesting is I think that the interesting dilemma of this game is this corporation, this mega corporation, is by all accounts, like, positive. It you know, pays for people's healthcare in a very broad way. It is, like, it does public works. It is the ideal cyberpunk mega corporation. And, like, the fundamental thing is, like, yeah, but it's still a cyberpunk mega corporation. It's still capitalism. It's still going to fuck with you. And is there good enough? Do you believe that there is a good enough here? And the fact that they missed this thing is, like, so frustrating, because yeah. it undercuts so much of what they're going for. Yeah. And in a weird way, maybe embodies it, right? Like, this is a developer who's doing their best, but at the end of their day, like, they still are going to drop the ball on this issue, because this is an issue that should be dealt with, like, way more care and knowledge and consultancy and all that other stuff. So, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I'd be singing the praises of this game to high heaven. You know?
Yes, same.
Would you say it is still worth playing despite the missteps at the end?
I think it is. I think that there is something here. If you go into it knowing that that's there and you feel comfortable, like, paying money for it, then, like, I guess, I think it does a lot. Well, I think there's other stuff that it does wrong. Like, I really wish that you could load a save in this game and, like, change your answer after you beat the game. It's called the Red Strings Club because there's, like, the red string of destiny, and there's a map screen, sort of a timeline screen, that breaks down all of the choices you made.
Yeah.
Right, so it's like, oh, you installed this upgrade onto this person. And then, like, down the road, like, 3 hours from now, you'll see that that person is different because you installed this upgrade that made them, like, a rebellious punk instead of, like, a good corporate lawyer, basically, or whatever, right? But there's no way to just jump back and be like, oh, let me try to install the other upgrade there. You have to start the game completely over. And you can fast forward, but, like, I really think that as a pure game, it would be so much stronger if I could just go, if I could do... It's not 999, it's the other one, it's the sequel to that game, right? That lets you just, like, jump to different nodes, Patrick?
VLR.
Yeah, VLR lets you... If it had that, where it's just like, let me just jump to this node, and I want to, like, duplicate this current timeline, and let me, like, tinker a little bit more, there would be a lot more of interest here, because there's a bunch of different branches that I haven't seen. But right now, like, given this, like, I would not, if I knew about this twist at the end, not the twist, but this the way that they mishandled this thing, I would probably spend my money elsewhere. Even though 2018 is slow right now, there's a lot of good games out there, you know? Like, I don't know, Slay the Spire is really good. Go read my piece on Slay the Spire. It's a roguelike card game. It's on the site. It's super good. That game's only like $15. So
I think this game is absolutely worth playing if they take this bullshit out and make a very easy fix to it.
Yeah.
I have, like, a moral problem with what they did here, and otherwise think that they made a really cool and interesting game, but this is, like, inexcusable. So, yeah.
Yeah, again, very frustrating because, like, Cyberpunk, there's a lot of room to play with as the genre. The genre has historically been beset by straightness and has recently gotten some really great queer work in that space. Queer and also, like, non-white work in the cyberpunk space. And so it was cool to see a game that was going that direction. And, you know, I hope that they continue making games. I'm not, like, retire, but, like, you know, take this criticism to heart and do better next time, because I'll play the next thing, you know, that they make. I'm curious about if they can internalize this sort of criticism and build something that's just as on point and then also just does not make this big, big, big mistake. So,
yeah.
What else? Are people playing things that are not super depressing and compromised?
I mean, it's maybe a little depressing, but in a good way.
Oh,
I
okay.
Think.
What are you playing?
I'm playing They Are Billions.
Oh, that is the zombie game. That is the
RTS zombie game, yeah.
Right. You're a zombie lord. No, you're not a zombie lord. This is not that game.
No, but it does harken back to a lot of oh my god. Okay. Listeners, there was a graph in my They Are Billions piece that really beautifully situated They Are Billions in the history of the RTS.
Uh-huh.
One would say it elevated the piece from, like, a take to, dare I say, a treatise.
Ah, yeah, of course.
And I think it really would have elevated both the piece and your understanding of where The Air Billion sits in the RTS space. But Austin,
that's me,
was like, Rob, no one cares about Warcraft 3 anymore.
I wasn't just Warcraft. I was very kind and very clear that 20-year-olds would have been 4 when Warcraft 3 came out. This is a graph that you talked about Age of Empires 2, and I know that people listening know what Age of Empires 2 is. I loved Age of Empires 2. But, you know, we have a lot of young listeners, and we didn't need a 300-word paragraph about Age of Empires 2. You can pull that graph up. You can read
that. When you give me the word count, that's fair.
That's what I'm saying.
That is a page.
And not just about Pat or Rob. This is not just about Age of Empires 2 and Warcraft 3. You're name dropping specific missions. There's a line in here. You're like the culling of Strathholm mission from Warcraft 3 when grieving
Jesus
and enraged.
Christ.
I liked Warcraft 3.
Yeah, 90s kids know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yeah, you heard Patrick's outrage on my behalf right there that you cut that reference. But anyway, so They Are Billions, though, is very much operating in the sort of classic base builder RTS mold, but it's not an RTS where it's all about, like, a multiplayer deathmatch skirmish thing. It's a, like, survival game. Basically, you start the game. You're sort of overseeing a little outpost, and then the map is filled with just sort of herds of zombies who, if they get into your town, will start infecting buildings, spawning more zombies, and it will quickly cause a chain reaction that will wipe out your settlement. So you have to build up defenses, and then, you know, at semi-regular intervals, defend yourself against waves. It's not quite as regular as a tower defense game, but every so often you do get a horde of zombies, which are just, it's a much bigger crowd, right, hitting all at once. And then they usually have special infected hitting at that time too, that will start doing special damage, or you know, you'll have giants show up and start leveling your walls. And you have to stay ahead of that and continue upgrading and improving your defenses and sending patrols out into the wilderness to cut down on the number of zombies that are in the world, to basically become the next horde. The whole thing reminds me a lot of, you know, if you liked those parts in the World War Z book that are about the practicalities of actually fighting zombie armies. This really scratches that itch in the form of a really traditional, really good RTS.
Right. The thing that ended up being really surprising for me in your write-up, there's stuff that was really good in your write-up was talking about the sort of clocks. I'm a big fan of clocks counting down, and the sort of rhythm of a huge wave hits and then you go into rebuild mode after you survive, and you fail to be as pessimistic as you need to be to see what comes next. That part is probably my favorite bit in this write-up. But the thing that I hadn't thought about that you then do situate it as is I was looking at this only as an RTS. It's oh, this is the game that I get to turtle in finally. I've played RTSs my whole life and I love building bases, and finally I get to have a game just about building bases. But you also kind of draw it the other way too, which is this is a tower defense game in which you actually have to be aggressive instead of just defensive, and aggressive in your architecture, aggressive in your layout. And that's not a thing that I had even thought about, having even watched 40 minutes of this game. I think that's really fascinating, because for that younger generation, tower defense games are everywhere. They've played all of these tower defense games on mobile, on Flash games, on HTML5 games. That is as trenchant a genre as the RTS was, I think, for us. And I think that this sits in a really interesting cross section between the two. Not cross-section, but, overlap between the two.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, it feels like, I said in the piece, it's kind of amazing that it took this long for someone to have this idea. Because it does hit on a lot of sort of mission structures and things that just people have always loved doing with RTSs. I mean, one of the main marketing tools for the Age of Empires games back in the day was to show people what sort of cool forts and cities you could build, in those games. Even if you never would do that in an actual match, it was cool that you could kind of build this entire medieval castle town, right? And defend that. This game actually lets you do that, and it's practical, but it also forces you to go out into the world and still do that classic RTS stuff. So it, at moments, is totally a tower defense game where you just have to huddle inside those walls and hope you can ride out the attack. But they aren't going to march obediently into your maze and get slaughtered that way. They can just break the walls of the maze.
Right. That's cool. This is in early access right now, right? It's just on Windows?
Yeah, and it definitely feels like there's quite a bit of development still to do on it. like right now it doesn't feel super balanced. I'm not sure the end game is all the way there. Basically, like, there's some really coarse-grained, like, tech progressions you can make. You go to tier 2, and then to tier 3, and it's all centered on, like, 2 or 3 different, like, research buildings. And once you get that building, you can basically immediately get all the new tech. There's no, like, choices. Like, once you can afford to scale up, you can just do that. And then you just buy the new best stuff and upgrade your old buildings. I'm hoping that there are more interesting dilemmas you'll face or harder choices you have to make about what kind of defenses you're building in later builds of the game. But right now, it's very much sort of a game where you're trying to deal with the steady ramp up of pressure.
Sounds good. Good.
Are there actually billions of them? It's a real question.
Good question.
There are not. Okay. And in fact, like, there's a lot of screenshots on the Steam store page that show a lot of zombie hordes that I sure haven't seen.
They're hiding. The billions are hiding, right?
But isn't it the sense, like, in the same way that, like, World War Z's trick, like, that, like, the at least the movie version of that, which is just an okay zombie flick, but, like, that one of the things that movie's successful at conveying is a scale of, like, what a horde is and, like, what that would be like to actually face. Mm-hmm. And so I almost wonder if that's the similar tack they're taking with their billions, is, like, it feels like a billion zombies, even if, like, the idea that, like, they're realistically going to model, you know, hundreds of thousands.
You'll still have those moments where, like, if you remember the World War Z movie, which, I can't believe we've both seen that.
If you like zombie fiction, there are enough bits in that movie that are interesting if you are interested in that sort of stuff, right? Like, the moment where they stack themselves to get over the wall is fucking
cool.
That's
the part I'm talking about, yeah. This is 100% that. Like, that moment where the zombies are just running up each other's bodies, like, starting to climb the wall. There's basic, like, they won't do literally that, but you will see these massive hordes, like, collect at one key point, and your amazing choke point, your funnel, you start to realize, like, oh, you've actually stacked up way too much pressure at one point and is mathematically impossible for that position to hold. And everyone's going to die because of that mistake.
Great. Good.
Thanks. Real cool.
I'm thrilled with... Yeah. Great. We should go to the question bucket before we're just too depressed to
let's
live.
Let's get some uplifting questions.
All right, Celeste is a good game and people should buy it when it comes out.
Yeah, wait,
Thursday
what is Celeste?
Switch, Xbox One, and PlayStation 4.
Tell me more about Celeste, Patrick.
It's a really good platforming game from Matt Thorson, the designer behind Towerfall.
It's a platformer, so it's just like, compare it to another platformer. I've seen very little of this. I was trying to watch on my phone while you were streaming.
I don't know what I would like directly compare it to, but it, like, in describing like what you do, like, it is a it's super Meat Boy-esque in that you are expected to die a lot. It is not nearly as brutal or as punishing as Super Meat Boy. Celeste sort of, like, gives you, if you want to participate in the masochism, it's more optional. You know, it's like collecting strawberries, which are just little collectibles around the environment. Like, the really difficult platforming challenges are tucked behind those strawberries, finding hidden walls that are, you know, indicated by, tiny changes in the environmental art. Those hide the real challenges. And the game does a nice thing where, like, it's the tooltips that occur during loading screens are just, like, these really nice, like, one of them is like, I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but it's like, hey, the collectibles are optional. It's cool if you don't want to get them. The game's fun without you doing that. There's another one, the tooltip that's, it's like, we don't think of your death count as the times that you're losing. Like, think of it as ways you're just learning how to progress and get better at the game. And I was like, those are just, like, really nice little sentiments, game. One thing I would say that's the way it's set up is, like, it's rather than giving a whole lot of options for the player, you just have a dash. You jump, and you can dash in 8 directions. And the game riffs on that by introducing sort of elements on top of that that are related to the environment as opposed to being giving the player a billion mechanics or abilities. So it's like there are sequences where there'll be like little like kind of blobs in the environment that you can shoot through, and when like your character dashes into it, it locks them into a dash in that direction, and if you run into a wall then you die. But so you're trying to position yourself in different ways to shoot yourself across the world to get to hidden areas and to not kill yourself in the process. The one thing that I think is interesting, I'm curious to see how it pans out, is that it's actually layering sort of interesting story on top of its platforming. Generally speaking, platformers don't have a lot of storytelling because they tend to rely, which is totally fine, to rely on the mechanics as the core appeal for why you're there in the first place. And Celeste has really, really good mechanics. It would be satisfying without a story that was more than just like a loose premise. But you're actually playing this character, Madeline, who seems to be having, I'm pretty early, so this is really a spoiler, sort of like various mental breaks. And she is dealing with mental health issues that like are the reason she is climbing this proverbial mountain that is the original premise for the game. So I'm curious to see where it goes, because it is trying to bite off a lot more than a platformer.
Platformers
tend to be premise and that's it. And Celeste seems to be saying that we're going to try and do something a little more, but I don't know how deep that is going to be.
Sounds like somebody didn't play Sonic Forces, which is a treatise on rebellion and resistance. Mm-hmm. The one that we need.
Well,
Hashtag
I don't think our readers know about Sonic Forces.
Austin, if you want to link me to your Let's Play of Sonic Forces, record all of your hours with Sonic Forces, I would
play through Sonic Forces.
We made the mistake of hyping up Knack 2 as the game that we should have forced ourselves to play, when Sonic Forces was probably the true game that we should have.
We could have made our own hedgehog or bird or cat or all sorts of different. We could have made Waypoint the owl. Bird we could have
dog.
Done it.
Waypoint the bird dog.
Is that one of the options?
I hope so.
Oh my god.
So maybe it was DLC.
Oh, I see.
Also, Celeste, which I streamed on the PC last week, I have since played on Switch, and that's the place where you should play.
It's all Celeste.
Right. I need
it's
to try
funny to bring that up, because very briefly, Rob and I have both been playing Darkest Dungeon on Switch. I'm not sure that's where you should play that.
Was really convinced this was going to be the platform where that game was going to... Like, it's good on PC, but I was like, man, if only it could be on Switch and it could go with me everywhere.
I might keep trying it on Switch, but yeah, it's a tough one. There's a lot of little text, and there's like this mix of touchscreen and like controller based interaction. It's
doing the simplest thing, like moving an item from general inventory onto a specific character.
Yeah,
requires a move set on par with like a Marvel versus Capcom game.
Yeah, I'm playing Monster Hunter, and I'm pretty sure I know how to reload my Switch axe better than putting a magical charm onto my Darkest Dungeon, like Paladin or whatever. It's not a Paladin, but you know what I mean. Crusader. I'm going to keep trying to play through it there, because I haven't played it on Radiant mode, and if I play it on Radiant mode, maybe one day I'll beat that game. That would be cool. So... all right, let's do one question, and then we'll call it a day from the question bucket. Let's do a couple. Also, wait, real briefly, Patrick, I turned on to your Celeste stream for like 2 seconds, and it was so. And as soon as I loaded it up, someone in the chat said they didn't like strawberries, and I don't know what to do with my life at this point.
Yeah, fuck them. Not strawberries. I don't know. Do what you want, I guess.
Like
strawberries?
That? Oh, sorry.
Wait, Danielle, do you not like strawberries?
No, I love strawberries.
Oh, okay.
Right.
They go off super fast, though. Like, real assholes. Oh, yeah. Like, you put them in the fridge, it's like, these are going to be delicious. I'm going to enjoy these for, like, the whole week. It's, like, disgusting, like, compost.
Okay, you gotta learn how to freeze fruit. That is, like a big life tip. Well, one, if your strawberries are lasting long enough to go bad, maybe think about eating those fucking strawberries, because I thought you said you were a strawberry fan.
We're in the Northeast, though. We get them, like... 25 days after they were picked.
No, I lived in California. It was happening there too.
I mean, they're way better in California.
They're just real shitheads.
Just eat the strawberries. Just like real. You know, guys were talking about like easy solutions to like problems. Like, here's an easy solution to this one. Eat the strawberries.
Just shove them in your mouth in the grocery store.
Just eat them.
Just put them in there.
Strawberries are so they're very good. They are I don't know if they're the best fruit, but they're my favorite fruit.
They're real good.
They're up there for me. They're definitely up there. Mm-hmm. All right, this question comes in from Craig from Baltimore, who says,
"I hate strawberries.
Hate them." Hey, Waypoint friends. Unrelated to the coming question, I'm a government employee. I find myself suddenly with lots of free time for no good reason. So why not text? Oh man. So why not write a text, Rick, for all of you to read? Feel free to edit and spice as you wish, as the subject matter interests you. Also, fuck this shit and save DACA and Chip. Empathy shouldn't be this hard. Shout out to Craig.
Well, Chuck's on half of that equation.
Oh, fuck. God damn it. So, I've been thinking about this for a while and trying to find a way to properly word it, so bear with me. These thoughts came up in conjunction with Quantic Dream before the current controversy, which is a whole other can of worms. I actually think it's a very overlapping can of worms. And the slice of their new game, Detroit Become Human, that they promoted, where the android protagonist, one of the android protagonists, is in a position where her actions could result in the death of a child at the hands of an abusive father. It got me thinking, in the hands of someone other than David Cage, I might be less pessimistic about how to approach such a delicate topic like child abuse. But it's not just David Cage. All media, not just games, allow for an author to determine cause and effect. Especially in the case of video games, with branching stories where you have agency in multiple interconnected situations, multiple causes and effects need to be put in place for the player to navigate. Basically, authors can create a world that acts in a way that they perceive. Games, especially in these situations of choice and consequence, are blurring the line between correlation and causation. In the real world, where every action we make can never be remade in exactly the same circumstances, games allow us to retry things indefinitely and come to as many different conclusions as the code allows. Let me take a breath. It's a big wall of text here. All right. I find all of this intriguing, but especially so in regards to sensitive, relatable situations that could at least tangentially occur in real life. In the hands of someone who has a skewed perspective of how society and human interaction actually works, side eye to Mr. Cage, one could make anything they want cause something else to happen. In a world of infinite replayability, literally everything you do is causal, no matter how mundane, if the code flips a switch and indicates something different will happen. If you didn't talk down the angry father properly, the code makes the child suffer. So according to the code, you did something wrong to cause that to happen. Obviously, in the real world, there's all this backstory and layers upon layers of nuance that aren't in a video game. So you can make a game where you ostensibly caused harm to an NPC because you wore the wrong makeup, or you spoke in the wrong tone, or because you didn't talk down the homicidal maniac. He goes on with a bunch of other things that just get very dark very quickly, so I'm going to move forward. This is especially problematic because there are real humans in the real world who do make these kinds of bullshit apologist connections and accusations, and perhaps someone who believes blame should be distributed towards the victims could make that correlation a reality in their own game work. Hopefully you survive this text wall. All that being said, games with branching story arcs are an intriguing way to view life and its systems through the lens of its creator, and can be genuinely satisfying if done realistically. So, if I were to distill this down into question form, do you think certain topics are better off not being in the hands of a user and their decision-making? Do you think some topics can't be presented in a way that would fairly consider the causes and effects of their actions? Is there a way to present controversial situations which can be repeated and changed in such a way as to affect the story but not necessarily associate blame in the wrong places? Thanks for all you do. Your thoughts mean a lot to me, especially Austin, who is holding down the fort as an Eagles fan in that office. Go Birds. Randall Cunningham is the best. Thank you. Thank you, Craig. Holding it down. Nick Foles.
He's known Nick Foles.
Nick, he's known. Who is? Who is? Nick Foles, Super Bowl champion. Nick Foles. Just wait.
I hope.
Case Keenum. That's a quarterback that's a lot like Nick Foles.
It's not. Yeah, exactly. That's who is exactly like that. It's all going to fall apart.
That game was a mirror universe. Like,
it really was. Yeah. It could have gone either way, but it was going to go one of those two ways. I think this is interesting because I think it breaks down this very complex and real thing. We've talked about this before with relation to the game Spent, I think is the name of the game that was about poverty, in which players were theoretically supposed to come away feeling like, oh man, it sucks to be broke, because if you're like, you know, a working class individual, if you're below the poverty line, everything's more expensive, it's really hard to dig yourself out. But instead, a lot of those players came out feeling like, oh no, you just have to be smarter while when you're poor, and you can totally dig yourself out. This is not a problem at all. Poor people
I would be
are
the
just
best at poverty. Exactly. Oh my God.
I would crush poverty.
Yeah.
Min max.
I would love to see the political ideology of people who came away feeling that way as well. Just
me
I've
too.
Always
me
wanted
too.
To know that when
well,
I hear that about
no,
that.
No, so that
game.
Was
yeah.
But
yeah.
Well, no, that's the thing. That's the thing is the study that figured that out, those are people who went in feeling like poverty was something inescapable. And the game, because it gamified it, made them change their perspective. It wasn't just that people who went in feeling that way came out feeling that way. It's that the people, like, they did the test ahead of time. They, you know, took that quiz ahead of time and, like, here's how I feel about this stuff. And then afterwards, because it had been broken down, as Craig says, kind of, like, into these clear causal relationships, because it had been sanitized of, like, the emotional weight, in a mm-hmm. sense, they came out feeling like, oh, it's just about lining the numbers up right. And that is really rough. And in the cases that Craig is talking about in Detroit, but also in you know, you can imagine a lot of other games that would try to tackle similar subject matter that has a lot of causes, like, though we do exist in a genre where there is almost a disclaiming of authorship, mm-hmm. where, like, David Cage can say, oh, there isn't you know, child abuse in this game if you play well enough. And he hasn't said that, but, like, he puts it on the player a little bit. But at the same time, it's his logic that leads to that thing, or it's that team's logic that leads to that event happening and like, saying, okay, here are the steps you need to take to prevent that result. And as Craig says, like, you can imagine all sorts of things here going way wrong based on what a dev's kind of personal ideology is.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes games so appealing is the feeling that taking fairly simple actions results in either heroic or dramatic results, right? I think that's one of the main appeals of games is saying, like, if I press these buttons in this order with this kind of thing, I'm going to get this amazing result. It simplifies everything about human action, and I sort of agree here with this idea that it could be toxic or it could be damaging in some ways to kind of do that, the input-output of that sort of ridiculous oversimplification. But in the same time, like, of course, anybody can make any game they want, but...
Right.
Yeah, like, yeah, I feel like I know it's so stupid, but because we live in 2018, everybody will misunderstand that. It's that's the number one thing, right? Nobody's actually calling for artists to not make their work, but is it potentially damaging? Sure. I think we're all kind of seeing the effects of oversimplification ruining our lives on a government level pretty often.
Right. I mean, like, that's the thing is, like, these are the stories that people in power do often tell. They do tell the story that is if she hadn't been wearing that outfit, or that is if this person had, you know, oh, they, why do they own a big screen TV? I thought they were poor.
If this
right?
one,
like,
simple thing, yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah, exactly. One easy trick to get yourself into to make yourself not a victim. Fuck
God.
Off. So I think that's interesting because games are in this very unique position. I'm the sort of person who thinks that all media is interactive and there are different degrees of interactivity and blah blah blah, but in games so much of the rhetoric around it and so much of the design of games does sort of put the player in the role of co-author. And you even think about something like grand strategy games, like I think about something like Crusader Kings 2 or Stellaris, where you can see communities like debate over the underlying ideology behind some of the game design choices because there's a difference in what they think is a sort of political truth. Like the big one in
some societies slide into oppression because the man at the top thinks that robots are just so incredibly awesome that anyone who doesn't agree should just be shipped off planet to
play some...
our least hospitable planets.
We should we should play some more Stellaris once that patch hits. But no, like, I think in Stellaris is a really good example where when that game launched, one of the divides that you could choose in terms of, like, or one of the kind of cultural identity divisions was either it was like individualist or collectivist, and the collectivist one was like ended up having bonuses for slavery. It was like, oh yeah, people don't mind being slaves because it's all for the collective. And the individualist one was like very clearly like Randian capitalism. And there was a huge debate about that and about that divide of like, oh, is this really the only version of socialism you can imagine as a place where people are literally slaves? And so they ended up changing those things. And there's a huge backlash in the community from a bunch of kind of Randian libertarians who had kind of disliked that the new kind of cultural ethics put in place were more about authoritarianism versus freedom. But boy, is it interesting to see that community fight over politics.
It's interesting and revealing as hell. You know, I think if you watch the reaction that some negative reviews of Stellaris got, particularly like Rowan Kaiser.
I freaking forgot about that. Jesus Christ.
He had a pretty significant harassment campaign like leveled against him by fans of Stellaris. I don't think that's an accident. There are aspects of that genre that play into a lot of toxic fantasies that like have unique appeal within like the history of like Western imperialist culture. And when your game sort of positions itself at the start as sort of ironically embracing some of those revanchist fantasies, community can take it in some interesting directions.
Yeah. I mean, I think this comes down, it's weird that we're on strategy games now, but I feel like I've mentioned this before, but one of my most interesting podcasts ever to listen to was the Three Moves Ahead on what's the Dianbian Phu game called again, Rob?
I think it might just be The Final Gamble?
That might be it, yeah. I think it's episode 305 with Kim Kanger, Kanger. Who's the designer of Dianbian Phu, The Final Gamble, which is about a very specific battle in the French war in Vietnam, and worked out a certain way. It ended a certain way, and there was a really good discussion inside of that. That's like, can games that are trying to replicate history, should war games, should strategy games, if they are left to be played out by the AI, should those end with the real historical end? If you're playing a game about World War II, if it's just the AI on the AI, should it be balanced such that the Allies win? Or do you leave the possibility space for an Axis win there, for the Axis powers to win there? Or even beyond that, how do you represent something when it's asymmetrical, and when the causes are so complex? And I think it maybe feels easier to talk about this than it does to talk about something like, parental abuse, as in the David Cage thing, because with like, when I watched that Gamescom footage from Detroit Become Human, like, my response was so purely emotional at seeing the cheapness of using the kind of assault on a child to generate an emotional response that, like...
Well, and then the text. It could have been different. If only you'd chosen differently.
Fucking God. Christ.
Yeah, it's... Games, one of their huge appeals is, like, they can give you this agency, like you were saying, Danielle, this agency and this ability to like have do-overs that like can never come in real life.
Yeah.
But trying to model, particularly like really particular individual like circumstances, like situations of domestic abuse, right? Like these are enormously personal, contextual situations that like, In some ways, history feels easier to abstract away into broader like historical trends and movements that you can then sort of discuss, from an armchair at arm's length. But when you're talking about these situations where one of the core dynamics is victim blaming and victim self-blaming, and then you systematize that and say outright that, well, if only you'd made different choices. along the way.
Right.
Yeah.
And like that can be applied to any sort of personal tragedy. You know, my partner was in a car accident last year. It was not a major car accident, but like it was a traumatic event. And like this is a situation where there weren't a ton of like really horrible ongoing consequences from it. Even in that situation, I watched her go through this process of like, oh man, if only I just why the fuck did I stop for coffee that morning? You know what I mean? Like, all those things that you do over a harmless situation. And now we're going to take that logic, gamify it around the worst possible thing possible. Like, that, you know, for some people's personal nightmare.
Right. Well, it's funny because I think the game that maybe does this the best that I've played in recent history was the original Life is Strange, which is literally about this obsession with, if only I could have done it differently, if only I could go back and change things. Like, that game lets you do that, and then also it doesn't let you do that because there are things that are too far back, or there are moments when your powers don't work the way you want them to. In Life is Strange, you play a character who has the ability to kind of rewind time and re-go through a conversation. And one of the reasons that works there is because a lot of the characters whom, on first blush, are despicable or who commit horrific acts, a lot of those characters are given an extra deal of nuance by being, because you're able to go back and see them from different perspectives, because you're able to explore these different lines of dialogue with them. And then also, it's totally willing to say, no, some of these people are just shitty. Like, the big bad villain of that first season does not have some, like, heartbreaking history, right? Like, he's just an asshole who does shitty things to people. Is willing to have villains, but also willing to say that, like, life is complex when even when people are hurt sometimes. It's funny that, like, the game that leans the hardest into that is maybe the one that gets it right. People should play that original game. I like that. I like that more than I thought I would.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's probably going to do it for us today. As always, if you have questions, you can send them in to gaming@vice.com. Use the subject questions. We'll be back all week for streams over on twitch.tv/waypoint. We'll be back on Friday for another episode of the podcast. We don't know what that podcast is going to be about yet, but we'll tweet about it, and you can send us questions for that. We'll figure it out. Danielle, where can people find you on the internet?
Danielle R.I. on Twitter.
How about you, Rob?
In the produce section of Wegmans, trying to find some strawberries that look like they'll keep for longer than the 6 hours that apparently I'm supposed to eat them within.
Patrick Klepek, how about you?
I'm going to go look into my freezer where I sometimes put the fruit before it goes bad because you put them in smoothies, you can put them in other things.
True.
You just got to be creative. Just,
strawberry smoothies, good as hell.
Oh, yeah.
Be your best Nick Foles, and don't allow your previous beliefs on strawberries to define your future. Sometimes you too can beat the best defense in football somehow.
Somehow. And not just somehow. He did very well. He did
very well. He had 143.6 like quarterback rating. It's a bullshit metric, but basically means he was fucking good.
Yes, exactly.
Doing right now, this minute. What is he thinking about?
I hope he's resting, and he's probably a little nervous.
Yeah.
But
I saw the post game interview where, like, they asked, like, how do you feel, like, do you feel bad for Case Keenum? And I guess, like, Case Keenum, like, good guy Case Keenum, actually, like, went up to him and said, like, hey man, you deserve this more than anyone, which is, like, what a, like, a nice thing to say after getting your ass beat, given that, like, those two are, like, the same type of quarterback. Yeah. Like, you could just, like, kind of flip a coin on them, and yeah. Go for it, Nick Foles.
Go for it,
Nick Foles. We believe in you.
Give me a win. We need a win this year. In fact, the Patriots.
America needs a win, which is that the Patriots don't go and present Donald Trump with another Trump Patriot.
God, can you imagine? Don't worry.
Fuck,
it's
Robert
2018.
Kraft.
What's going to actually happen is the Eagles are going to win, and then they are going to go to Donald Trump.
Oh, no.
Nick Foles is going to shake Donald Trump's hand with a big smile, and I'll cry. Find me on Twitter at EaglesFan12. Shout out to Randall Cunningham.
The 12th Eagles fan.
That's me, the 12th one.
OG.
OG. OG Eagles fan. Find me at Austin_Walker. Find Waypoint at twitter.com/Waypoint, facebook.com/Waypoint Vice, youtube.com/Waypoint Vice, twitch.tv/Waypoint, and as always, waypoint.vice.com. Shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the song Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. That's Bowen. That's Bowen. That's his name. All right, that's going to do it for us. Danielle, what do we say to him?
We say be good and be good at it, and even if you came up in New England, don't root for the Patriots.
Wow, big word.
Bodied.
Right. Peace.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.